The Women's National Basketball Association started its 14th season this past weekend. It still can't touch the NBA when it comes to money and prestige, but its fans are fiercely loyal. And for pro basketball fans in one former NBA city, the women's game is all they have left. NPR's Martin Kosty reports from Seattle.
It's been 2 years since Seattle lost the Supersonics. 2 years since the team's new owners pressured public officials for a new arena, and when that failed, moved the team to Oklahoma City. Supersonics, we're missing ya. Supersonics, we're missing ya. 2 years for grown men to bare their broken hearts on YouTube. But broken hearts can heal if a guy is willing to take a chance on somebody new.
Please welcome up for the first time in 2010, your Seattle Storm!
The WNBA Storm is still here. It almost left for Oklahoma along with its sibling team, the Sonics, but it was saved by four season ticket holders, four women who ponied up $10 million to buy it and keep it here. The new owners also kept Karen Bryant, a former college player and now team CEO.
Get her, Lauren. No, she traveled!
Courtside at the home opener, Bryant can barely stay in her seat. In a break in the action, she says it was sad to see the Sonics go, but she doesn't seem to miss sharing the same owners.
You know, I think for us it's about being in control of our own destiny. And, you know, there's something to be said when you're in control of your future, for better or worse, and there's no position we'd rather be in.
The atmosphere in the arena is nothing like the NBA. Instead of cheerleaders and spandex, the Storm has a dance troupe made up of grade school kids. The place is filled with families, and the courtside seats seem to be occupied by a lot of prosperous-looking women executive types, not to mention on opening night, U.S. Senator Patty Murray. The few Sonics fans in the crowd are careful to show proper respect.
L.A. versus Seattle. For women's basketball, this is the coup de grace.
Kelly Rembolt means that as a compliment. He was comped some excellent seats as an enticement to convert him from dedicated Sonics fan to dedicated Storm fan. Enjoying a beer, Rembolt's buddy David Soberg praises the game's physicality.
I mean, I didn't realize how rough the WNBA was. I mean, it's pretty rough.
Still, the guys say it's just not the same.
Nothing will fill the void until we get NBA back in Seattle.
Totally. I mean, this is badass, but Sonics, no.
Storm fans are used to attitudes like this. Patty Squires is a radio reporter who's covered pro women's basketball in Seattle since the early days.
A lot of people don't see the WNBA as real basketball. Personally, I think it's better basketball. It's team basketball rather than hot dog basketball.
And if Sonics fans aren't ready to commit, the Storm isn't going to beg. In the locker room after the game, co-captain Sue Bird says the team already has solid fan support.
I mean, if you ask players from opposing teams, they do not like coming here to play. It's loud, it's rowdy, even when we're not sold out like we were tonight.
Outside the players' entrance, autograph hound Ryan Phillips still wears his Sonics t-shirt, which sets him apart from the crowd of girls and parents. He'd rather be hunting Kevin Durant's signature, but he admits that he's warming to the idea of women's basketball.
This is my, I think, third game.
So you like them?
Sure, they're fun, yeah, they're fun, yeah.
Despite this lukewarm affection, Phillips will have to wait for those autographs, because the players are taking their time in the locker room, celebrating their win over the L.A. Sparks with a giant box of cupcakes. Martin Kosty, NPR News, Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. We've reported frequently from Michigan throughout the economic crisis, and this week we're focusing on Detroit. The Motor City has big problems and limited resources to fix them. Now, the people of Detroit aren't just waiting around for conditions to improve. Some are joining neighborhood groups and block clubs to do crime patrols and clean city streets. And in many places, it's working. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer has the first report in our series.
Detroit is a city of wreckage. That much you've probably already heard. To see it is another thing. Neighborhoods where abandoned houses outnumber occupied ones. Empty houses blackened by fire, with rain-soaked furniture and clothes thrown around the yard. It's the kind of devastation you usually only see on the Weather Channel. But for an outsider, what's even more surprising than this wreckage is how many really nice neighborhoods are literally right around the corner. One street will look like a tornado came through. The next has perfectly manicured lawns, shady trees, and friendly neighbors. So, how can the most troubled big city in America also have some of its nicest-looking neighborhoods? Like Thompson runs the Urban Studies program at Wayne State University in Detroit. Here's how he explains it.
There's some heroes out there in those streets.
Heroes who've stepped up to keep their streets clean while city services withered. Much of the work has been done through what Thompson calls an ecology of community groups, and there are a lot of them.
At one point, the city did a analysis of it, and they found over 1,200 nonprofit organizations, 501c3s, with real budgets. So that's a large number.
And many of these groups are working right in Detroit neighborhoods.
Good morning, Bishop.
Good morning.
Good morning, Marcia.
Hey, good morning.
Every weekday morning, volunteers for the MAN Network meet in Detroit's Osborne neighborhood to patrol the streets while children walk to school. MAN is an acronym for Maintaining a Neighborhood, and the four members of this morning's patrol team are all wearing black clothes and black hats with the word RESPECT stitched in white lettering. On the roof of the car, a yellow light noisily rotates. Bishop Tony Russell started the MAN Network about 4 years ago to get people engaged in the community and stop crime.
It's just a fact that the police generally are only called after crime has been committed. And we want to be a force to prevent crime.
They do that mainly just by keeping watch. If something more serious is going on, they have sheriff's deputies on speed dial. Earlier this year, the patrol helped stop an attempted rape in an abandoned garage across the street from an elementary school. Marcel Copeland joined the MAN Network 2 years ago. He grew up in Detroit with the mindset that he couldn't do anything to fix the city. But now that mindset has changed.
This is where I live. It could be where my children will live and my grandchildren live. So why make myself live somewhere that is, dangerous and dirty when we don't have to?
And while more people like Copeland step up in Detroit, large organizations are able to do more. The Skillman Foundation has given money to help children in Detroit for half a century. A few years ago, the foundation announced a $100 million program targeted at six Detroit neighborhoods. Ed Ignatius helps lead the program. When it first rolled out, he was told not to expect much involvement at meetings.
We were told 100 people would come out. And do you know, we would have, every 3 weeks, we'd have a series of five meetings in the beginning in all six neighborhoods, and we'd be averaging between 300 and 450 people.
The money from the Skillman Foundation helps support a lot of work in the community, including the patrols by the MAN Network. And there are several other foundations with their own programs. But in some parts of Detroit, it's clear that even this is not enough. Children in the Osborne neighborhood walk to school past half-burnt houses and piles of trash every day. Tony Russell says he doesn't expect the city or anyone else to clean up the neighborhood, but he does need some help.
We should be able to maintain our neighborhood, but many times we just don't have the resources necessary.
Despite the millions of dollars poured into Detroit and the thousands of people doing work, Russell says more can and will be done as Detroiters step up to fix their city. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Our series on Detroit continues this week with a look at retraining unemployed auto workers. And we'll hear about the city's Hispanic business community, which is thriving.
Before actress Angelina Jolie immortalized the character of Laura Croft as a hero, before Halle Berry became an X-Man or Linda Hamilton brought down a Terminator, there was the original Foxy Brown.
It could be your brother, too, or your sister. Are your children? I want justice for all of them. And I want justice for all the other people whose lives are bought and sold so that a few big shots can climb up on their backs and laugh at the law and laugh at human decency.
The iconic character, Foxy Brown, defined the era of black female blaxploitation in the 1970s. Proud, sexy, hip, and strong, actress Pam Grier, in her roles as Foxy Brown and Coffee, showed us that black, in all its strength and power, was beautiful indeed. But in real life, Pam Grier is a survivor. Her new book, Foxy, My Life in Three Acts, takes us inside her world of grit and triumph. And if being an author weren't enough, she's also in the new movie, Just Right, starring actor/musicians Common and Queen Latifah. The author and actress is here with us now. Welcome, Ms. Grier.
Welcome, is what you're saying. I'm in shock. I was listening to my voice back in that scene. Thank you for the invitation. It just took me back. It was quite emotional. Well, I remember doing that scene, and it resonated to a lot of my community and things that I'd seen and happened, and I was really feeling every word.
It resonated in what way?
My mom was Coffee, and my aunt was Foxy Brown. And in my community in Denver, there were certain areas that were quite deprived and angry, and you could see the people preying upon one another, victimizing one another. And it was very harsh. And my mom was always, some of her friends, the mediator, trying to stop the fights, trying to stop the madness. And she was always taking care of people. And it was just, I don't know, it just moved me to hear me give that dialogue.
Well, in that case, we're going to move you again, because now I've got to play a clip from Coffee, your other iconic
role. Oh, no. It's torture.
Come on now. Look, I ain't gonna shoot you.
Please, don't shoot. Don't shoot. I'll pay you anything. $1,000,000. Whatever you want.
Okay, $1,000,000. You got a deal. I won't kill you. It's your friend Brunswick I want anyway. Where is he?
He left. He went to his house at the beach.
Yeah, I know the place. Thanks.
Do you still terrify some men in this day and age?
I think they may wonder if I'm still going hunting, and but I don't think I intimidate men today. I've been meeting quite a few men, and what they say is they're proud of how I interact with them, and that they want their ladies, their girlfriends, their daughters to be assertive and intelligent. And when you are, I think men respect you more.
You've been identified so deeply with the feminist movement, and that is a big part of your book, how much that has meant to you. Do you think that the roles that you have played have changed or affected the way people viewed women in our community and women in general?
I have a small part. But I think the outcome, or even the general spreading of the word, was that women need to be at some point independent, not codependent, so that they can be a partner, have equanimity in a relationship, not necessarily wear the pants or take the man's role, but be a real partner to make men feel confident. And it was about empowering women, because we may not be accepted by a man. We may not become married. We may be an independent woman forever, for life, and we need to be self-sufficient. My grandfather wanted me to be that way. He said, we went hunting and fishing. He said, you need to bring the boat in. You need to know how to drive the tractor. You need to know how to do things. It really works in the city. And it might intimidate some men. Men my generation, perhaps, but not younger men.
I remember, and don't be mad at me for saying this, but when I was growing up, there was some drama going on in parts of the community as to whether those films were creating a bad stereotype for black people. You know, the Superfly, the Coffee, the Foxy Brown. Did you catch any, shall we say, pushback from the African-American community?
It could have been. My focus was on getting a woman into a leadership role in the films, the one as a heroine who was courageous and strong. And what I wanted to do in the community was show our ills. Instead of sweeping them under the rug, let's address them. So that was my focus. And there were quite a few films done before mine. They weren't called blaxploitation. Not until a woman did it and I had stepped into the roles or the shoes of a man. Now it's blaxploitation because here's a woman posturing as a man, laughing and joking and being powerful and strong like a man. And all of a sudden, there's an issue. Well, to me, it wasn't an issue. To me, it was letting our community see what was going on.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes, and I'm talking with actress Pam Grier about her new memoir, Foxy, My Life in Three Acts. Ms. Grier, I want to actually talk to you about some points you made in your book. You were talking about your mom and the way you grew up, and she taught you not to look at color at a time where black people weren't even allowed to try on clothes in stores. How did she go about doing that, and how do you think that changed you?
There were times where we would go into department stores. And, you know, we were coming into an era of busing, anti-segregation. We were going through social turmoil. And in some of the department stores, we could not try on clothing. And when I went out to Los Angeles, I was so amazed. Not even a shopping spree. I was going to find something to wear to work on one of my five jobs that I had. And it was in Century City, West Los Angeles, very progressive city. Mm-hmm. And when I went into the store, the sales girl was so, "Hi, how are you? What were you looking for? Can I help you?" And she started handing me these blouses, several of them, and skirts, and can try them on and let me know if you need. She was so friendly and open. I was stunned. I had to call my mother that evening and say, "Mom, I got to try on clothing at the store." And they just, you know, were so liberal and kind to me. I was taken aback by that. And she said something, "Well, baby, that's how it should be. And it will be even more so." And I said, "Mom, you're going to come out here and I wish you could experience that." And I brought her out and she was just so amazed for all the marching, and her generation had suffered so much, and my grandmother and my great-grandmother. And I said, "Mom, I wish we could tell everyone how wonderful this feels. And I don't think many people would understand that today, not knowing that what we had to go through was something so profound and humiliating every day that my mother went through."
I need to ask you about something else sad, and I'm sorry about this, but you wrote that you were assaulted when you were just 6 years old, and again when you were 18, and it caused you to kind of stutter and stop talking for a while. I wonder how you survived that and how it has affected the woman you are now.
When you talk about surviving, you really don't know how you will survive each year. There are times where when I'm frightened and I feel uncertain, my stutter returns, and I have a mechanism that controls it. Yes, it returns. And I don't know if you ever get over or survive. Some people do. I can't speak for them. I know what my difficulties are, and I am able to understand them. I've had discussions about them. The third attempt was the time when I decided I'm fighting back. It is not going to happen once more. And I remember fighting so with desperation, with all of my might, to not allow this to happen a third time.
Wow.
So I just don't want others to experience what I had. And I see it. I see dysfunctional behavior, abusive behavior in families passed on from generation to generation to generation. You see it every day. And you don't always get over it. You might split, you might hide, you might repress emotions, but it's something that will be with you forever.
But still, you write about a Jewish Talmud verse that's special to you that says, "Every blade of grass has an angel that bends over it and whispers, 'Grow, grow.'"
Yes.
I mean, you're able to come back from that to that positive thought.
I get to a positive thought. Could it be better? Possibly. But I have so many angels, so many people in my career, from Tim and Daphne Reed to Quentin Tarantino, who invested 2 years of his life to write Jackie Brown for me. I've been fortunate. The lifelines of, you know, from doing film and having producers and directors still interested in my work, you know, it keeps me occupied. It keeps me from thinking about things that would take that positivity away from me.
Let me ask you about the movie that you're working on now.
I'm working on a movie with Tom Hanks right now, and I play Julia Roberts' best friend. It's called Larry Crown.
Wait,
Los Angeles.
This makes me laugh a little bit because a couple of months ago there were people talking about how there was the whole black best friend thing. So really, you're Julia Roberts' best friend in the next
yes.
movie?
Yes.
What's it about?
Well, Tom Hanks' character loses his job at a major store that he had been with for a long time, and he was the exemplary employee, and he didn't have a college education. He has to go back to school, City College, where he meets Julia and myself. And he reinvents himself. And it's a wonderful movie.
I have to ask you, what do you want your legacy to be? I mean, you're obviously still working. It's not like you're retired or anything. But what
artists
is it?
Artists don't retire. We don't retire. What's my legacy? I survived cancer. I was given a second life. There's nothing more important than your health. And you always maintain balance in your life, which I share in Foxy, My Life in Three Acts.
Pam Grier is the author of Foxy, My Life in Three Acts. She joined us from our bureau in Culver City. Ms. Grier, thank you so much.
Allison, I'm weeping. You've taken me back to these places. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for your invitation.
The book, by the way, is available in most major bookstores. You can find out more at our website, npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep along the Grand Trunk Road, where some young people are deciding if their future is at home in Pakistan or abroad. We'll have more this hour.
I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Lynn Neary. This morning, we're also following the effects of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Public support for offshore drilling has fallen, though 54% of Americans still favor it, according to the Pew Research Center. In Congress, some members are seeking measures that would ban offshore drilling. NPR's Yuki Noguchi looks at what it could mean for the nation's energy future.
There's nothing like a long, rust-colored stream of sludge threatening the nation's southern shores to bolster the case against offshore drilling.
Make it clean! Make it clean!
Here, a group of protesters chant in front of the White House. Washington, at least for now, appears to be listening. The Obama administration suspended its Virginia offshore drilling plan. Several new bills in Congress propose to halt all new activity on the West Coast or off all national waters. In addition, the Senate's climate change bill includes new provisions allowing states to veto any federal plans to drill within 75 miles from their shores. And Florida may consider a ballot this fall blocking drilling off its shores. But some say cutting off future domestic drilling projects could do the country more harm than good.
We should not overreact because there was an incident.
Gal Luft is executive director of the Institute for Analysis for Global Security. The group is a think tank that advocates for greater energy independence. Luft says reducing consumption or investing more in alternative energy sources is not a practical solution to the fundamental problem.
As long as our cars, trucks, ships, and planes can run on nothing but oil, we will always be beholden to the same constraints that we are facing today.
Moreover, Luft says, though the U.S. now gets only an eighth of its energy from off its own shores, the supply from continental domestic reserves long ago peaked and is now diminishing. So he says cutting off offshore drilling will make energy more expensive. And the U.S. would become more dependent on oil-producing nations that pose a threat to the country.
The price of oil will increase and all of us will pay more at the pump. So from an economic standpoint, this is a self-defeating proposition. And from a national security standpoint, this only going to exacerbate the very same problems we're trying to solve.
If there's one point both Lutz and environmentalists agree about, it's that the prospect of cutting back domestic drilling has shed an unflattering light again on the country's dependence on foreign oil. But Ethan Manuel, a lobbyist for the Sierra Club, says whether we expand drilling or not, either way, we're heavily dependent on oil imports.
So we could drill everywhere. We could drill in Yankee Stadium, we could drill in Yosemite, and we would never find as much oil as we need to supply the demand here in the United States.
Manuel says the oil shocks of the early 1970s also inspired calls for more domestic oil production. But since then, U.S. crude oil imports have tripled. The only real solution, Manuel says, is to innovate through alternative energy sources. And without a moratorium on new drilling, there will be fewer incentives to do so. The American Petroleum Institute argues no moratorium is necessary. The trade group ran ads like these promoting the benefits of offshore drilling in 2008 when President George W. Bush lifted an executive order banning the practice.
Now more than ever, it's time to put America's energy to work for Americans and America's economy.
That's still the basic argument Eric Melito makes today. Melito is API's director of exploration and production. He says the offshore industry supplies hundreds of thousands of jobs. But he admits, given the visibility of the Gulf disaster, it's harder to make the pro-drilling case these days.
It's difficult given the incident in the Gulf, and we want that to be a one-time incident, never happens again.
He calls it a freak occurrence, but at least, he says, he can still say he has a majority of the public on his side. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Patients may like the idea of speed dating to find a new doctor, but there are those who think hospitals are going too far in their efforts to attract clients. Some critics question whether hospitals should be advertising at all. Critics like James Unland. He's the editor of the Journal of Healthcare Finance, and he joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Good morning. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Lynn.
What I was wondering about this is why advertising is needed for a hospital. It seems like most of us only go to hospitals when we have to. It doesn't seem like the kind of product or service that we would use because we saw an ad that somehow impressed us.
I am not opposed to hospitals marketing appropriately to their own service areas. My issue comes with the huge expenditures on TV and broad-based media advertising that's very, very expensive. They're doing a lot of radio, a lot of billboards, and some of the billboard advertising is making claims that are questionable in my view. I mean, there are some things that hospitals need to get the word out on, but they can do that through public service announcements. For example, if they're giving swine flu vaccines, certain types of screenings. The media is almost always receptive to doing news reports or doing PSAs.
Now, one argument that I've seen in favor of advertising for hospitals is, I think, speaking to what you have been alluding to, and that is the idea of advertising in a local area, because some of these smaller hospitals are trying to persuade people to go to the local hospital and not to travel to a bigger city or a bigger hospital and perhaps even spend more money.
Well, I think that hospitals have much more cost-effective weapons at their disposal now than TV, radio, or billboards, and so on. First of all, direct mail. More important than that is the Internet. The great thing about the Internet is that the unit cost of telling the story of the hospital and what services it has is minute, and you can tell a long story. You can interview your doctors. You can give people a virtual tour, you know, that type of thing.
Earlier this year, the Vermont legislature toyed with the idea of banning hospital advertising. That idea was scrapped. But do you think it's a good idea? Should hospitals be banned from advertising altogether? Can they be?
I don't know if they can be under freedom of speech, but I think the better argument to make to hospitals is for regulators and people to say to them, look, you have a charitable mission. Don't throw this money down the drain in expensive TV ads where you only get 30 seconds of advertising. Use your money more wisely.
Well, when did it become more common for hospitals to do this kind of advertising, and what was the impetus behind it?
It became more common really in the 80s when hospital executives started being wooed by ad agencies and when they started to succumb to, frankly, the sex appeal of TV ads. And hospitals, especially in metro areas, became very competitive, and they figured they needed to brand themselves. But the problem in metro areas is that each hospital only serves a tiny percent geographically of that area. So, for example, in the Chicago area, a hospital that serves 250,000 population catchment area may be buying ads for a population that reaches 10, 20 million people.
So it's not worth the money they're spending, you're saying.
Exactly. Actually, the marketing that hospitals do is just as better done to doctors, because doctors are the lifeblood of hospitals. More than 90% of patients encounter hospitals by a referral from a doctor.
Right.
So marketing and having events that bring doctors and patients together is a good idea, but that's a very local idea and doesn't require throwing money at TV and radio.
James Unland is editor of the Journal of Healthcare Finance. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.